I have finally made the leap to Patreon, so now you have some options. You can still sign up for the exclusive feed through Red Circle, which is your best bet if you listen on Apple because you can just add it then to your favorites feed. That's $5 a month for ad-free episodes, and then there's bonus exclusive episodes that come out twice a month. But if you are on Spotify, you now have the option to sign up through Patreon. That's $3 a month if you just want the ad-free episodes, and then $5 a month if you want both ad-free and the exclusive episodes. Now, if you're already signed up for the exclusive for the $5 a month and you prefer the option of only $3 a month for just the ad-free, you can cancel with the Red Circle at your next renewal and then sign up again under Patreon. And if you did sign up for a year at the time under the Red Circle exclusive feeds, I think it works out that you're actually getting both ad-free and the exclusives for $3 a month, so you should be good. I am venturing back overseas today, but I have to say a bit reluctantly. For the first couple of seasons, I stuck to mostly Canadian cases because, well, to be honest, I mispronounce places in my own country. I don't really have a hope of pronouncing them in other places that I've never been to. But I do know that murder is murder, and cases that I just find that are interesting to learn about that I want to cover, but I posted a case on YouTube over the Christmas holidays that took place in the UK. And can I just say, am I the only one that, being Canadian, which is part of the British Commonwealth, did not realize that their road signs are in miles per hour and not kilometers per hour? I was really shocked to learn that. It was actually the most fascinating thing to learn about that entire case. But I was even more shocked by how upset some viewers got about it. One comment in particular said that I needed to stop making content altogether for not fact-checking. Anyways, I have thick skin, so I can take criticism, and I really do dislike getting in trouble for getting things wrong because I pride myself on having like a personal understanding of how important if something goes into a false narrative that can be. So anyways, my ego was bruised about the whole thing, but I just have to get back on the horse because I think there are just too many victim stories that need to be told. And of course, not all of them happened in my own backyard, which is probably a good thing. This is the murder of Tracy Woodford.
I don't remember anything after I left the house until I got to jail.
The law didn't come into my mind. I wasn't caring about the law. I was dealing with dead children on my hands. Fuck the law. I'm in trouble, man. My kids are dead.
But once I lied, I continued to lie. Yes, sir.
Wow.
You know, oh, what a tangled web we weave. But once I told the lie, I had to keep lying.
And what kind of person would do something?
I know.
I'm asking you, what kind of person do you think would do something like that?
Obviously not someone, not a good person.
So we are back in the UK today, but not in England. It's in Wales, which is a country all its own. It is west of England, and that's really all that I'm really going to say about it because I have never been there. I, of course, don't have the authority to be talking about what it's like there. And the where is actually not important to my story, but rather the who. But I will tell you that in Wales, there's a place. Now, it's referred to as a small town, but as Canadians, we would probably consider it like a small city. It's got a population of about 32,000 people. Now, I've listened to people with Welsh accents pronounce it, but I've heard it a couple of different ways. I've heard Pontypridd, Pontypriad, and Pontypritt. Now, apparently, lots of people shorten it to Ponty, which is rather convenient for me, but I'm going to go with Pontypridd. Because that's how it seems to kind of roll out of my mouth easily. It looks lovely. There's some amazing sights there. Lots of bridges to see. I would love to go there. Living in Pontypridd was a woman that I think I would personally classify as complicated. She was just a little thing. She was very slim. She was only about 5 foot tall, reddish blonde hair, and a really wide smile. Her name was Tracy Elizabeth Woodford. Now, Tracy had been born on February 13th, 1968, and she grew up in a town just outside of Pontypridd, where she lived with her mom, Linda, and her brother, Sean. She also had a sister named Sharon as well, but Sharon was married. She lived really close by, but not in the family home. She was married with her own family. Unfortunately, I don't know a lot about Tracy or her family life, but I know that she was very much deeply loved and she's been missed. She's described by her friends and family as super kind, just a very gentle soul. Her brother Sean said of her, quote, "Tracy was a very kind, caring, and loving person who didn't have a bad bone in her body. She wouldn't hurt a fly and was just a quiet, gentle soul. She was a devoted daughter to her mother, Linda, a wonderful sister and sister-in-law, a great auntie to her niece and nephews. She didn't have much in the way of money or possessions, but what little she had, she loved to give to the three of them or would love to buy them some sort of treat. Just put a smile on their faces. That always made her so happy. That's just the type of person she was," end quote. She lived with her mom and her brother, but she would sometimes stay at her sister Sharon's, or she would like pop by for a visit. It was about every other day. So she was very close with her family. She did not go out a lot. She was kind of a home bug, preferring to do solitary activities like crossword puzzles. Now, not knowing a lot about her, the UK Sun had a headline that read, "Vulnerable woman," or something like that, called her something like that. And in 2015, she was single. She was unemployed. And I think that kind of had more to do with her being maybe neurodiverse in some way. And again, I don't know anything about her. I just kind of get that feeling that in some way, like maybe cognitive function, mental health, or some kind of substance issue made it difficult for her to live completely independently and to work full time. So she stayed close to home and to her family. Now, she did go out, like she'd go to the post office and to do some grocery shopping for her mom. And she did like to stop in at pubs around town. So she was social. So she could do things independently, but there was something that made her vulnerable to, like, I get the sense that she was 47, but that her decision making and her judgment was maybe closer to like a teenager. Now, I could be way off base with that. And if I am, then my deepest apologies to the family if I am. I just want to sort of lay some groundwork that, you know, sometimes there's cases that, oh, well, she brought it on herself by her choices, that kind of story. And I just feel that Tracy was absolutely lovely. She was maybe a little bit quirky, but certainly she was well regarded in her community. There's been some coverage that, although I wouldn't say that it's victim blaming, it just kind of paints her as this unemployed beggar kind of woman that was self-destructive. And then the focus, of course, becomes on the person that killed her and not about her family that has really truly been affected by her death. Now, I know you guys are sick of hearing me talk about this, but I really don't care if you are a complete piece of shit type of person. Like, you lie, you steal, you cheat, whatever it is. You don't deserve to be murdered. Like, maybe there is some shitty things that you do deserve, but being murdered is not one of them. And I'll tell you why. Now, this is just my opinion. If you are a super shitty person, then, like, let's say you've murdered other people or you've preyed on children or animals, like something really, really terrible. You deserve to suffer for that, for sure. And that's just my opinion. And I think that the only path to suffering is life. Death is an end to suffering. Now, on that other end of that same spectrum, if you are a light up the room kind of person, your death then is the beginning of the suffering for your family and friends. And you have lost your ability to live a life that may or may not include suffering and struggle, but it's your future. your what if has kind of been taken from you. And both ends of that spectrum suck. So in my opinion, no one deserves to be murdered, and certainly not the quirky and gentle, quiet Tracy Woodford, who one article described as nervous and fragile. Like, come on, there's no way she deserved to be murdered. So on the afternoon of April 21st, 2015, Tracy, who again was 47, she let her mom and Sean know that she was going to go do her regular shopping trip for groceries for the family. I believe that that was a weekly thing that she did. And one of the stops that she was going to be making was to pick up this ring that, it was from a place that is referred to as a cash generator shop, which I believe, and I could be wrong, that I think that's something that we would call a pawn shop. So now all the reporting that I have read, I couldn't track down the actual court documents, so I have to go with what's out there on this, that she made a deposit on that ring earlier and she was purchasing it rather than selling it. Now I have no idea if it was a normal thing for her on these weekly excursions to stop at a couple of pubs on the way home, or if this was a one-off, but she went into a place called the Tumble Inn Pub and she stayed there for a little bit, had a couple of drinks, and then she left and went to Alfred's Bar. Now, and apparently at Alfred's, she fell off her bar stool a couple of times and another patron at the bar had to kind of help her up. So she was described as intoxicated. Well, the next morning, Sharon, who's her sister, ran into her mom, Linda, out shopping, which was a little bit odd. Like normally Tracy did the weekly shopping, but Linda asked Sharon if Tracy had maybe spent the night over at her place. And when Sharon said no, they both immediately knew that something wasn't right because she also wasn't answering any of their calls. They didn't think that she was murdered, like not that kind of wrong, but maybe she did stop at the pubs and maybe she had a problem with drinking, but she always came home to either her mom's place or her sister's place every night. Like she wasn't like a bar fly that would go picking up random strangers or going off partying for days, staying out with friends. She was, again, remember, she was described as nervous and fragile, so she came home. So they immediately reported her missing to the police. And again, not that they were concerned that she had been murdered, but that maybe she had some kind of mental health issue, something like that. So they were concerned about her welfare because the missing poster that was posted on Twitter and on Facebook said, quote, "Tracy, we are here for you whenever you are ready. We can listen, talk through what help you need, pass a message for you and help you be safe. Call, text anytime, free, confidential," and then gave a number that you could call. So I think the initial feeling was that she was maybe going through something and her family was worried about her reaction to her emotions more than being concerned that, you know, somebody had grabbed her and done something to her. But the police were taking it seriously. And so they start the process of trying to track down her last known movements, which being that there's CCTV cameras are everywhere, that was fairly easy to do. So they can spot her coming out of this cash generator pawn shop and then going into the Tumble Inn and then also the Albert Pub. And they did talk to the bartender there that told them that she had been falling off the stool a couple of times and had been described as intoxicated. And then at about 7:45 that night, she walked into a place called the Skinny Dog Pub. And when they went in there to talk to the people that worked there, the bartender, her name's Rebecca, she told them that when Tracy had come in, she had been, or at least showed signs of being intoxicated. So Rebecca had refused her service of alcohol, but did give her a Diet Coke. And then she had gone and joined a table with three other guys that was kind of flirting with her. And then one of the guys was named Christopher May, who was a kind of a regular, or not kind of a regular, he was a regular at the bar. He was one of the men that was at this table. And she did hear him say to her, "If I buy you a few drinks, maybe you'll come home with me tonight." But that Tracy had told him that she wasn't that kind of girl. And then Christopher had just sort of sloughed it off as, "Oh, I was just kidding anyways." So, and then the conversation continued after that. And although Rebecca didn't serve her any alcohol directly, She couldn't say that one of the men hadn't bought a drink and then given it to her. But another customer did observe Tracy saying to Christopher, to the man at the table, that she was cold and that Christopher had given him his coat. So although he was clearly hitting on her, and she had refused that part, they were still being friendly with each other. Well, all four of them, Christopher, his two friends, and Tracy, all left the pub together around 11:20, and then they kind of split up. One friend was headed for like a street vendor or kebab shop thing, and Tracy and Christopher were headed towards the Pontypridd railway station, which is on the way to Christopher's apartment. Now, I'm not sure where the other friend went off to, but they were all seen on CCTV footage at that time leaving the bar. Christopher May had been a butcher working at Hadley's from the time he was only 14. He was apparently very good at his job, but he left that in 1991. And I'm not sure why he left butchering, because, like I said, he was good at it. He worked as a time some other odd jobs. He'd worked as a dishwasher, a cab driver. He'd worked in a factory. And he had moved to Cardiff, which is actually the capital of Wales, when he was 31. And he'd met a woman named Tina. I don't think that the two of them ever legally married, but they had two kids together. And then in 2002, they separated and moved to a place called Adderdare and then on to Pontypridd. His ex-wife, Tina, unfortunately died by suicide in 2010. And Christopher was kind of well-known around town. He had quite a few friends, but he was a big drinker. Now, Rebecca, the bartender there at the Skinny Dog, she said that he was a regular. He came in pretty much every night and would drink about 6 to 8 beers, but she never had to cut him off or anything. She said that he always remained a perfect gentleman, and sometimes she would drive him home after closing time. And other friends that he had described him as a bit of a joker, a nice bloke. He liked to watch rugby, was a good for a laugh, never really talked about too much personal stuff, but he was always very pleasant, certainly not angry or a violent drinker. But he did keep to himself for the most part, like he'd work, go drinking, go home, rinse, lather, repeat kind of thing. So at the time, Christopher was working at a place called the Grill Steakhouse as a dishwasher. And on the 22nd, he had come in with some scratches on his face. He said that he had been working on building this wall or something for his parents, and he had bought this pole, like a big wooden fence post type of pole from the hardware store. And when he was carrying it, he accidentally hit himself in the face with it. Well, his coworker, Charlotte, she didn't think much of that at the time. And that story kind of lined up with what Chris's neighbor, Cheryl, had said, that she had seen him the other day. He was carrying this big fence post thing and said that he was taking it to his sister's place. Now, she did mention that he looked knackered, which means super tired, like exhausted tired. And then the couple that had lived below him, Michael and Gail, they had heard a big thud or like a thunk that night around 2:30 in the morning. And it had woken them up, but they did, again, they didn't really think much of it. They just, I mean, they knew that Christopher usually came in drunk, but that he lived alone and was pretty much always alone in his place, except for like he'd have the odd male friend that would come by to watch a rugby match with him or something. Well, so they run this little background check on Christopher, and it comes back that in 1995, he had been convicted of arson. He had set a school on fire, and then when the firefighters showed up, he was actually found inside the school in the music room just playing the piano. And he had gotten 18 months in prison for that, and he also had a couple of minor burglary charges in 1982. So he would have been in his 20s. And then there was a couple of DUIs, one in 2005 and then another one in 2010. But they managed to track down this other waitress that worked also at the Skinny Dog. Now, I probably can't pronounce her name because it's Celtic, but I think it's Cerise. And she said, and I quote, and this is from Wales Online, which I believe was court testimony that's being quoted, quote, he was ordering his drink and made me come to his close to his face, which made me uncomfortable. He started talking to me about his love of redheads, how we are perfect and good in bed, which quite offended me. He asked if he could look at my fingers. I hesitantly put my hand out and he grabbed hold of my fingers. He seemed disgusted by the way I had my fingers and he said I should look after them better and was stroking my fingers. It upset me and disturbed me that he was saying these strange things to someone who was young enough to be his daughter, end quote.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
At Fresh Time Market, we have a healthy obsession with produce. Not only are we committed to offering the freshest selection of organic, seasonal favorites, and Midwest-grown fruits and veggies, but our team members have tips, tricks, and other info up their sleeves. Like, did you know cherries have melatonin? Or that you shouldn't wash blueberries until right before you eat them? Or that when cranberries are ripe, they bounce like a ball? Crazy, we know. For all your fresh produce and unrivaled expertise, stop by your neighborhood Fresh Time today.
So maybe it's time that they go and talk to this Christopher May person and see what he knows, because clearly he was the last person that she was seen with, and she was seen going with him in the direction of his apartment. And well, Tracy is also a redhead. So two officers were sent to his apartment to talk to him, and they knock on the door and he does open it. And as soon as he opens the door, they are hit with this waft of, it's like a mix between bleach and, like, one of the cops described it as cat urine and sour milk. And then the other officer said it smelled like gone off meat or spoiled food. And they asked him the usual starter questions. Have you seen this woman? And he told them that, yeah, he'd seen her. He was a little bit squirrely eyed about it, but he said that he had left the guinea dog pub together with her that night or the other night. And he figured he was going to get lucky, but on the way to his place, he tried to cop a feel with her. Those are his words, not mine. And she told him to piss off and then she walked away. Now, this was on the 24th of April. So it's 3 days after Tracy had last been seen. So they asked if they can kind of come in and look around real quick. It's just part of the procedures, you know, nothing to be concerned about. And he said, well, you know, he's right in the middle of busy cleaning and it wasn't really a good time. Maybe they could come back another day. But of course, they persisted. And he said, no, you know, we'd really like to check it off our list today so that we can move on to some other things. So he finally let them in. Now, it wasn't a big apartment, so there wasn't a lot of places to really check and look at. But based on the smell, they were starting to think that this was going to be a cleaned up crime scene. Like, the kitchen was all in order. So they moved down the hall to the bathroom, and the bathroom was spotless, which is a little odd for a pot-bellied heavy drinker in his early 50s. But it also stunk to high heaven. But stinking like there had been a dead body in there isn't exactly proof of a crime. That is, until Sergeant Williams, who was one of the officers that was there to check things out, pulled back the shower curtain. He pulled it open, He shut it again, and then he pulled it back just to be sure that his eyes weren't playing tricks on him, hoping that what he initially thought was some mannequin parts thrown into the tub bottom were actually mannequin parts and not the arms and legs with no torso or head of a human female. Sergeant Williams turned to Christopher May, who was kind of standing looking defeated behind him, and told him that he was under arrest for suspicion of murder, and Christopher said, "I know." Now, the other officer on the scene, his name was Constable Craig Gardner. He actually later broke down like into tears when he was recalling the scene to the jury before he had referred to it as watching some kind of horror movie. When loading him into the patrol car to be taken in for questioning, obviously, they asked him where was the rest of Tracy. And he said, quote, "Some of her is in the cupboard and in the drain at the Pontypridd RFC, which is the rugby club." So while he was being chauffeured to his interrogation, at which he only would tell them like where the parts of Tracy could be found, but he never would admit to actually killing her. The forensic team took up this task of hunting down the remainder of Tracy's remains. Now, while they were still in the apartment, they did find some rather gruesome things, including a handsaw, a Stanley box cutting knife, scissors. There was a pair of pruning shears, a duvet wrapped around two duffel bags, one that contained some blood-stained clothing, and the other was an Adidas bag that contained Tracy's upper torso. In her purse, like her purse, was found the top of her thumb and four fingers. The fingers, of course, lined up with what was left of the right arm that was found in the bathtub. So cops then descended on the RFC, which is the Pontypridd Rugby Club. So they cordoned that off to the public, who were, of course, looking at this scene with rather quite a bit of curiosity. They searched all of the grounds, the stands, the tree-lined area that kind of surrounded the field and the stadium. And then on the following day, on the 25th, two officers just decided to poke their head into the storm drains. Now, they were large enough storm drains that they could kind of walk in them, like crouch down. And one of them happened to turn his head to the right, just as like the kind of a wave of water was coming in on his left side. And he spotted someone looking at him, only she wasn't looking at him because it was only Tracy's head kind of perched on its side. It was there on a ledge in this darkness of the tunnel. There had been slash marks on her face as she appeared to have some bruising around her cheeks and her eyes. And next to her head on the same ledge was another duffel bag. Now, this one had bore the Iceland Football Club logo, and inside of that was her lower torso. Once Tracy's parts had all been collected and then reassembled at the morgue, an autopsy could be done by pathologist Derek James. Her cause of death was cardiac arrest caused by pressure to the neck. There was also semen found on parts of her body that, of course, they were able to match to Christopher May. And Dr. James found that the dismemberment of Tracy had been done by someone that had a lot of experience with knives and butchering techniques. So the police looked at Christopher's laptop as well and all his search history, and discovered that on the early morning of the night of Tracy's murder, he had spent several hours viewing a variety of porn sites. Now, Christopher May pleaded not guilty on the grounds that he had acted in self-defense. And I just want to remind you that Tracy was all of maybe 5 foot tall, maybe 100 pounds, and described by everyone who knew her as a gentle soul. But okay, let's go with self-defense. So his story is that he had met Tracy at the Skinny Dog pub. They shared a joke or two, nothing serious, and he started to become attracted to her over the course of the evening, likely because she was rather frail looking, a redhead, and that she was intoxicated, which I guess is his type, because he needs women that are vulnerable and not able to make good reasoned out decisions. He doesn't tend to do well with women otherwise. Now, he didn't say that. I'm just conjecturing that that's what why he was attracted to Tracy in particular. Anyways, he asked her to go back to his place and she said yes. And they stopped under the railway bridge on the way to his house and had what he called a kiss and a cuddle. Then they went back to his place. One thing led to another. They got undressed. And here is his quote. Quote, "We started having a kiss and a cuddle and one thing led to another and we had sex. We were fully undressed." End quote. Which I think is a weird thing to say. Like, why do you have to mention that you were fully undressed? Perhaps he's used to leaving his socks on or something, and he feels it necessary to point out that this was extra consensual because he had time to take his socks off or something. Anyways, they fell asleep, and when he woke up a little bit later, he said that Tracy was standing next to his bed and was going through his wallet. Quote, "I said, 'What are you doing, you thieving bitch?' She came at me flailing with her arms. I tried to defend myself by stopping her. I got hold of her hands and pushed them away from my hands. She called me a fucking prick. I lost control. I don't remember then. Next thing I know, she was on the floor dead. I couldn't believe she was actually dead. I sat on the couch and had a cigarette. I panicked and tried to get rid of the body. I thought if I cut it up, then I could hide it." End quote. So he started to cut off her arms, but he got sick doing that and then lugged her into the bathtub until he could kind of gather the intestinal fortitude to continue the job. He carried some of her parts in bags to the storm drain, hoping that they would wash out to sea. Then he said to the jury in a plea for mercy, "I am disgusted with myself. I can't apologize for it. I can't ask for forgiveness, can I?" End quote. Now, Roger Thomas, who was the prosecutor in the case, he gave a closing statement that probably didn't even really need to be said. Quote, "The defense admits his actions were responsible in causing her death, but disputes his conduct amounts to murder. The prosecution says that this was a brutal, vicious, and sexually motivated murder. After her death, she was mutilated and dismembered. These actions were carried out deliberately and methodically with the intention of concealing her body parts and thereby evading detection." And he reminded the jury that Tracy was a slim, petite, single woman who lived with her mother and brother, and that Constable Craig Gardner couldn't hold back tears when he'd been testifying about the moment that he pulled that shower curtain open. It seems that his expertise in butcher shops has been put to use on a human body. One has to consider what this involved. The defendant carrying a body part and a head from his flat across part of Pontypridd, entering a dark tunnel and walking into it for 138 meters. You may want to ask what was going on in this man's mind. We submit this was a deliberate murder inflamed by sexual passion, and it was deliberate and callous and act thereafter to dismember her, conceal her, and dispose of her, and that ultimately you are presented with a worked out defense. They claim that he had become rather impatient when his wooing attempts had not worked out for him, and that's when he flew into a rage and strangled her to death before having sex with her corpse. He later used a saw, this Stanley box cutting knife, and some pruning shears to chop up her body into pieces in the bathtub. Some of her remains were flushed down the toilet and some were kept in the home, but he placed her severed head in a plastic bag and stashed it in a local storm drain. Now, his defense attorney, Malcolm Bishop, he tried to leave the impression on the jury saying that there was, quote, no evidence of sadistic conduct, end quote. But his claims of self-defense were ultimately rejected, and instead the jury sided with the prosecution that he had in fact killed Tracy in a fit of rage and that this had been a sexually motivated crime. Chances are she had not consented at all to sex, and that had enraged him, and he'd killed her by strangling her and then tried to cover it up by dismembering her and then littering her parts around the rugby club. He just simply didn't have time to dispose of her arms and legs before the police showed up. And so they convicted him of murder to shouts of yes from the court gallery. The jury did give him the courtesy of deliberating for 54 minutes, though, before they decided. Justice Nicola Davis sentenced him to 28 years to life in prison and said to him, "Your murder of Tracy Woodford was cruel, callous, and determined. These same characteristics prompted you in the hours and days after her murder to dismember her body and deliberately conceal it. You did this for one purpose, to avoid detection and arrest you for the murder that you knew you had committed. You embarked on this without a thought for your victim and still less for that of her family, whose grief for their daughter and sister was made more anguished by the grim dismemberment of her body. Now, I do want to read from you the Woodford's family statement. This was given outside of the Cardiff courthouse because I don't want to leave you with the memory that Tracy Woodford was the woman in Wales that was dismembered and her head found in a storm drain. So the family statement read in part, "No words can begin to explain what Christopher May has done to our family. His action on that night in April and over the following days with what he did to Tracy's body has destroyed us all. We simply cannot understand how anyone could treat another human being this way." And then her brother Sean and his sister Sharon added, with their own statements, "The thoughts and visions of what he did to Tracy have haunted us every day for the last 7 months and is something we will never get over. Our mother has nightmares most nights, waking up screaming and crying out Tracy's name, asking, why did he do this to her? We see the devastation in each other's eyes and know the hurt that the other is feeling and know that we are helpless to stop the pain. He didn't just kill Tracy that night. He killed a part of all of us. The fact that he didn't admit his guilt at the earliest opportunity and instead put us all through the trial has only increased our pain." And then her mom, Linda, told the media, she was talking about what it was like to see Tracy's body at the morgue. Tracy had led a simple life which revolved around her family. She was happy doing her crosswords and wouldn't have hurt a fly. I miss her so much. I wake up in the morning and the first thing I think of is Tracy. Every day I just get by. I am surviving. I started to get distressed when they started to tell me what happened to Tracy's body. It was like I was living in a nightmare. I didn't want to believe what they were saying. I thought, what person could do something like this? What did he do to her? I stood over her crying. I didn't know what to do or to say. I kissed her on the forehead and then had to leave the room. This man has torn my family apart. It destroyed us. It has totally destroyed us all. People say time is a great healer. We can honestly say that no amount of time will ever heal our pain or fill the hole that this monster has left in our family," end quote. And so those are kind of the words that I want to leave you with, that the pain and suffering that begins and it just never ends for a family who's has a loved one that's murdered by another human being. It doesn't matter if the death came quickly or slowly. It just doesn't matter. There is really no other loss like losing someone through violent crime. It is its own unique grief. And I certainly don't want to mitigate anyone's grief. If you have lost someone by an illness, through an accident, if you've lost a pet, that is grief. I just feel that there's something very unique about losing someone through someone else's actions. But I'm going to be back again next week with another case of unimaginable and unending grief for a family. In the meantime, you know, leave your reviews, your rates, subscribe, you can comment, all that good stuff. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
At Fresh Time Market, we have a healthy obsession with produce. Not only are we committed to offering the freshest selection of organic, seasonal favorites, and Midwest-grown fruits and veggies, but our team members have tips, tricks, and other info up their sleeves. Like, did you know cherries have melatonin? Or that you shouldn't wash blueberries until right before you eat them? Or that when cranberries are ripe, they bounce like a ball? Crazy, we know. For all your fresh produce and unrivaled expertise, stop by your neighborhood Fresh Time today.